Watch and wager on exciting Southern California thoroughbred racing. For more, visit losalamitos.com.
Biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Took a trip on a bus that I didn't know. Met a girl selling drinks at the disco. Said truth comes back when you let it go. Seems complicated because it's really so simple. Walking down Young Street on a Friday. Can't follow them, gotta do it my way. No fast lane, still on the highway. Moving in and out, no doubt there's a bright.
No time to get down, cause I'm
We're back. 15 minutes in to hour two after visits with Gustavo Delgado Jr. and Robertino Diodoro. Lots of vowels going on there. Lots of. Rich Migliore is going to join us for his Monday visit and after a season of America's Day at the Races and Saratoga Live and hours and hours and hours of coverage. I don't even know how many. I'm sure somewhere in a press release it says how many hours of coverage there was this year. But it's a lot of work, and everybody really appreciates it and enjoyed it, and it enhanced everybody's wagering and race viewing pleasure. Rich Migliore, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Yeah, it's didn't really hit me till this morning that I let down, and then I was like, wow, I'm kind of tired. But this week, at least I don't have to shave. Today, I'm not going to put any contacts in. I'm wearing my glasses. It's kind of one of those dreary, rainy days in the Hudson Valley. I went out to the barn, and the three dogs walked out the door with me, and then two of them stopped at the edge of the garage and refused to budge. Only the big dog was going through the barn. And I tweeted out last night that it was a wrap, and I really appreciate all the kind words from 99.9% of the people, but one guy had a right to go, and I said it's a wrap for the good. You stunk. Oh, thanks.
Well, how different is it, Rich? You know, from the boo birds and the rail birds, and certainly at Aqueduct, there must have been a couple of times the Jamaicans were hooting and hollering at you, walking back to the jocks room.
Honestly, I think I can remember just one time where the Jamaican guys got after me, and rightfully so. I had ridden a really bad race, but most of the time they were great to me. They were like my best fan base. I love those guys. They loved me. And still when I see them, you know, they respect Sir Champion Jockey, and you know, they actually watch a race really well, by the way. I'm going to tell you that.
Yes. One of my favorite memories that sticks in my head when I bring this up is Jose Santos. Jose had ridden badly, I guess, and I can't remember the specifics of the race, and everybody was kind of watching him, you know, kind of with his head kind of down, and one of the Jamaicans goes, "Santos, you stink." And everybody just started a laugh, and even Jose looked up and smiled.
They're human. We're human. They happen. I do remember one time it actually got a little serious. My wife Carmela was still working on. She was assistant to Bobby Reinecker, and they had a horse in the race. I didn't ride their horse, and we're walking back up to the tunnel, and it was. You know, I had broken my neck in 88. I was out 6.5 months. I came back, and so I was back riding, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. And I had gotten back into a good swing. I was doing well. And a guy started giving it to me, but nasty, you know, like way out of line. And he said like something to the effect of that I should have died in that spill. I should have been paralyzed, whatever, you know, something bad. And Carmella kind of flipped the halter that she was carrying at the guy because, you know, it's my wife and she was there next to me when I spent all that time in the hospital, intensive care and everything and rehab. And when she did that, all of a sudden I see this tattooed arm come up from behind the guy and just like clothesline him and took him down. And it was like a feeding frenzy, like something you'd see like Piranha. Like the next thing I know, my brother Michael came up from out of it with the guy's shirt in his hand. And then, you know, like security guards were on him, and I knew the guards, and I was like, oh God, you know, what did my brother just do? And I was like, please, can you do me a favor? Just get him out of here. And they took him downstairs and like, so go out the tunnel and get out of here. And they let him flee the scene. And I called him that night. I was like, what? You can't. What's wrong with you? He said, well, I heard him. I wanted to kill him because I saw what you went through. But then when I saw Carmella flick the halter at him, it was a green light. I saw, oh, God, thank God he didn't go to jail.
Jesus. I've even used the, you know, the railbird analogy when it comes to, you know, internet, you know, trolling and saying, you know, would you pay any attention, you know, to, you know, to some, you know, somebody yapping, jawboning at the, you know, at the racetrack. And frankly, even I'll even put my own hand up. I've told the story about, you know, my heckling Tony La Russa, who I think very little of. And that came at Montreal in Olympic Stadium and had a little bit of a shouting exchange with La Russa once. So I guess I qualify as one of those guys.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah. All right, I'll take it another step further. And so, my good friend Rick Franco, Franco Wine Importers, he had a box at Shea Stadium at the time for the Mets, right on the third baseline. And I forget the name of the third base coach for the Colorado Rockies. So my boys and my brother Michael, again, we go to the game. We're having a great time. Incredible box right on the third baseline. And the guy's name wasn't La Russa, but it was like La Rocca or something. And,
yeah.
And a really, really kind of a short guy, right? And, you know, listen, for all I know, probably the most wonderful guy in the world, but my brother Michael's a bit of a wise guy. And he starts, like, the seventh inning saying, you know, hey, again, I think it's La Rocca. Hey, La Rocca, why don't you stand up? You know, and he's heckling the guy, right? And my boys, you know, because I'm much more reserved than my brother, if you can believe that, and my boys thought this was hysterical, and the people around us were like chiming in, and it, you know, kind of took off, and I thought, I was actually feeling bad for the guy, and so, you know, we left, and my sons were like, oh my God, Uncle Mike's crazy, you see what he did, and they thought it was hysterical. So, I don't know, 2 years later, I go out to California to ride, and we're at Del Mar. And one of Bill Spahr's owners has a box for the Padres, San Diego Padres. So he gave me the box, and it turns out it's like right on the third baseline, similar to, you know, the seats we had at Shea, and me and the three boys are there, and we're having a great time. And who are they playing? The Colorado Rockies. And who's the third base coach? The same guy. So about the fifth inning, you know, I'm like, well, my boys thought that was hysterical when my brother did it, so I start. I go, hey, La Rocca, why don't you stand up? Right? He turned around and stared right at me. My boys went under the seat. The people around us, like, pointing at me like a completely different crowd than Shea Stadium. And I'm like, oh, God. And then we're leaving, and my boys are reading me the right, God, it was so embarrassing. What you do? I go, oh, when Uncle Mike did it, it was fine. So it completely blew up on me. But the difference between going to a game in New York, it's like, you know, beer here, you know, your hot dogs, beer here. And there, it's like Chardonnay, Merlot. You know?
Well, they famously they arrive in the third inning and they leave after the sixth. That's the famous attendance plan out there.
Well, how about what I did one day? We go to a Yankee game, and I know I'm going to kind of mix up the details, but it was essentially this, that I had a workhorse the next morning. We got there for batting practice. You know, with my sons, it was a dark day. We have a great time. You try to make memories. And it got into the, you know, late innings, and they were losing, I guess, 5-1. And by the end of the eighth, it was like 5-2, and now they had like two outs in the ninth. I guess, come on, guys, let's come on. We got to get out of here, right? So we get to the car, and we start the car, and I'm pulling out of the parking lot in Yankee Stadium, and it's bases loaded, two outs. Scott Brosius is up. And as we hit, like, the Cross Bronx Expressway or wherever we were, Scott Brosius hits a grand slam, a walk-off grand slam. And we left. To this day, if I take my boys to a sporting event, they don't care. We are not leaving until the final out, the final whistle. And they were so mad at me. And I deserved it. I mean, they missed the walk-off grand slam. We listened to it on the radio.
We had one like that. I can remember when I was a kid. We used to see a lot of Red Sox games. My father's company had unbelievable seats at Fenway. I mean, literally seven or eight rows up from the end of the Red Sox dugout. And they were down like 10-3, give or take. And you know, we would go regularly, so you know, you didn't really think much of you know, all right, they're beaten. And it was either our neighbor Mike Cedar and his dad Lenny, my dad worked with for years, or it might have been Joe Gottlieb and one of his sons, but there were four of us, and so we left, and sure enough, as we're driving home, we got the game on the radio. Red Sox chip away. I think we had left like after the seventh, and wow. Red Sox scored a couple in the eighth, and you know, it's an hour and 40-minute. Drive from Boston back to, you know, back to the Hartford area, back to Manchester on 84. And
right.
With a stop probably at Howard Johnson's for
of course,
but
of course.
Coffee for me. And they end up scoring. They scored like either six or seven runs. And maybe it was in the ninth. I should look this game up. I could probably find it. And, It was dramatic. I'm pretty sure they won 11-10. I got that number in my head, but I know that feeling. When you say there's no way they're coming back and let's go. Next thing you know, you've missed a dramatic rally.
Comeback. Yeah, epic comeback. Well, and then the flip side of that, we went to a Ranger game and I took both of Billy Badgett's sons. And we were at the game, had the five kids and me, and the Rangers were winning like 5-0 in the third period, and they were playing the Capitals, and Ovechkin just started going mad. Like, there was no way they could lose. It's like the horse, like, 5 in front with a 16 to go, and, you know, we'd, like, Luciano was about 5 years old, and he's dancing in the aisles, and like it's great. And all of a sudden, it was boom, Ovechkin 5-1, boom, Ovechkin 5-2, boom, Ovechkin 5-3. I think he scored 4 or 5 goals, and with each successive goal, everybody's getting more and more tense. Like, oh my god, oh my god. But when they tied it up, Luciano's 5. He took off up the steps. He was leaving. I'm leaving. He's heading for the subway by himself at 5 years old. I had to, like, run him down. They wound up losing 6-5. It was, like, the worst meltdown. I had to take them all for pizza afterwards when we got back, like, to calm them down. Good memories.
I love it. Well, I'm going to put up a question on Twitter. We're going to get a survey out here. What was a sporting event where you left and missed a big comeback? I'm going to put this up here. There we go. We'll see. We'll see what kind of answers we get. I love it. There we go. All right.
Years ago, Steve, real quick. When I was a kid, my father would get home from work, and he would say, you know, like out of the blue, you know, it would happen sporadically. He'd go, all right, we're going to the Guards and Rangers are playing tonight. And my mother would make sandwiches and stuff in a brown paper bag. We'd go catch the subway, me and my four brothers, and we'd, you know, go to the Garden. I think it was like $2, $2.50 to get into the blue seats back then. And, you know, and it was great. I mean, we were up there, but it's just, the, you know, the Garden and, like, the excitement and everything. So now, you know, years and years later, I have my first son, Joseph, and I have access and, you know, some disposable income. I can get good seats. And, like, when you're up there, you're like, wow, what it must be like to be down, like, ice level, against the glass, whatever. So I take Joey to a game, and we're, like, literally next to the Rangers bench, right up against the glass. And he's looking around, having a good time. He's little. And he turns all the way over and he goes, Dad, wouldn't it be great if we could sit up there? I was like, I worked my whole life to get down here. He's down here. And he's like, wouldn't it be great to get up there?
That's tremendous. That's tremendous.
Grass is greener.
My father became a Rangers fan. You know, he came to the country in 1939, and he reminds me of, and he says the Rangers were terrible during the war years, but he says he used to go out. You could get into those, you know, those standing room seats, and this is the old Garden. I want to say 1944 or 1945. My father said he saw every single Ranger home game. And I think paid 50 cents or even less, maybe, for whatever those standing room seats were in the old Garden. And you could stand in the back.
I remember my dad saying the same thing, that he, you know, as a kid, they would go and it was like 50 cents, 75 cents to get in. And by the time, you know, we were kids, like I said, if I remember, it was like $2.50. So, you know, like, and again, you know, my mom would make sandwiches for dinner for us, and we eat them on the subway on the way there because they didn't have money to, like, you know, go buy, you know, junk food at the Garden. But it was always a big treat, and the excitement, and I loved, you know, just, you know, when you're with your brothers, and, you know, I was the youngest, and we were also, like, even with my brothers, nothing for us as kids to, you know, when school was out, get on the subway, head up to Yankee Stadium and buy the, you know, the upper deckers and be with like 20 kids from our neighborhood. And it was a different time. Kids could do that, jump on the subway and kind of roam around and be okay, you know?
And I'm just looking this up because now it made me curious. And of course, back then, you know, they played, you know, with the original six, you played 25 home games and 25 road games, each of the, you know, original six teams. And so you know, 50 game seasons. And in, this must have been the year, or it could have been, boy, it could have been either one. 43-44, they were 6-39-5. And then in 44-45, they were 11-29-10. And then in 45-46, they were 13-28-9. So my dad wasn't kidding. They stunk during the war.
Well, I'm excited about our prospects going forward. I think we've got a great group of young, talented guys. I'm excited. Anybody who follows me on Twitter, I love hockey. It's, you know, next to horse racing, it's like my favorite sport to watch. So,
no, there's big, you know, we've talked about this many times, and we've had some good. Any number, right, of hockey related guests visit between Eric Johnson and who do we have? We had Dennis Savard. We've had of course Eddie O and Olchek. I mean, there's real parallel between a lot of crossover hockey racing.
Well, absolutely, their internet Eddie O is just fantastic. I mean, what you know, his wealth of knowledge in both hockey and horse racing. And a while ago, when Ernie Munich and I used to do the Dark Day shows for NYRA, Welcome to Race Day on the NYRA Network, and Mitch Levitis produced them and directed. And we had we had to fill a lot. There were a lot of smaller tracks, and
that's right.
We would have a special guest like every, you know, Tuesday or something, and I had to try to guess who it was. Well, we had Jules Villemure, who was the Rangers goalie, And, you know, which I was blown away because he loved horse racing. He was like a fan of mine. And here I was as a kid, you know, before Jockeman became, where he was like the backup to Jockeman. And so now we're talking on the show, on the phone. I'm talking to Jules Villemure, like, this is, you know, surreal. And he was saying how he and Roger Bert had, like, made a big score on some horse that I rode. They were at the races, and they bet on the horse, and it was like a big
That's
deal.
Great.
Yeah, and so I had to tell him, I had a Roger Bert story. So my brother Nicky had his first car, like, this pasted together Dodge Dart in the 70s, and where we read in the paper, the Daily News, that Roger Bert is going to be signing autographs at the Green Acres Mall in Valley Stream. Now, Valley Stream might as well have been the moon from where we lived in Brooklyn, especially with that car. But we all decided we're going to go, you know, I'm like 8, 9 years old. And my brothers, we pile into the Dodge Dart. We go out to Green Acres. We made it, you know, I don't know how. And we stood online. It seemed like forever, you know, especially when you're a kid. But it had to be a few hours. And we're like 8 people away from getting Rod Gilbert's autograph. And they closed the line. Mr. Gilbert's got to leave. And he left. And I was like, you know, you're just so disappointed and crestfallen. And so I tell Jules Villemure this story, and I said, and I after that, I wasn't a Roger Bert fan anymore. I couldn't be, like, you know. And he was laughing. He said, I'm going to get Rod to send you an autographed picture. No, I don't want it anymore.
That's great. I love it. There's a few. God, this is the problem with you and I together on these Monday visits, because we can just go meandering in any direction. Again, because you just made me think of my father telling me a story about being, you know, the knothole gang at Ebbets Field and, you know, waiting till the Dodgers, you know, would come out of the clubhouse. And, you know, most of them lived right in the neighborhood. And, yep. You know, the kids would literally walk home with Dodgers to their, you know, brownstone. I mean, that just such an era that is, I mean, is so far gone. But he tells a great story about Hugh Casey, who's widely recognized as one of the first closers, you know, one of the first guys to close out games. And Casey had blown a save. You know, I don't even think they kept saves at the time. But right. So a kid asks for his autograph, and he says, sure, turn around. And the kid, you know, thinks, oh, he's going to sign on my back. And he said, you, Casey, kick the kid in the ass.
Oh, God.
And sent them flying. Oh, my God. There's a book that's long out of circulation and very hard to find. It's amazing. And I don't have a copy anymore, and I really would love to get one. Speaking of Hugh Casey and his drinking pal, Kirby Higbee.
And that's a name I remember, which I must have read something about him, because obviously it was before me. But
oh, it's before all of us. You know, it's the 40s and, you know, the 50s. And Kirby Higbee wrote a very literate, and, I mean, a book that that I remember reading as my dad got me as a kid. He wrote a book called The High Hard One. And they talk about things like Jim Boughton and, you know, Ball Four and the like. But really a forgotten piece of, you know, sports literature. He was from South Carolina, and Hugh Casey, he tells their stories in there. Hugh Casey would spend winters with, he was pals with Ernest Hemingway.
Wow.
And Higbee tells the story about going down to Havana with Hugh Casey, and the two of them, and I'm sure Higbee got drunk too, but the two of them getting roaring drunk and then clearing the living room of the furniture and having wrestling matches, like brawls. Like they would, I mean, which you can imagine, I mean, given, you know, given the reputation of of Hemingway, but the high hard one, Kirby Higbee. Higbee, there's a famous story about with Higbee. He came back from the war, and his wife. He's back from being in the service, and he's pitching for the Dodgers, and he comes home, and his wife confronts him with a perfumed letter from some nurse in the South Pacific. It says to him, "What's this?" And he looks at it and says, "It must be another Kirby Higbee."
Oh my gosh, that's great! Oh my god, this must be. Oh, that's so bad. Hey, all right. So I know we're supposed to be talking horse racing, but I got to tell you the story.
Go ahead.
So I'm riding, you know, Caesar Kimmel, John Kimmel's dad, and you know, I had ridden for him since I had the bug, you know, like when John was in veterinarian school and Jimmy Toner was his trainer, and we had always been friends, you know, invited to great parties at Rockefeller Center where they would light the tree and we'd watch it from his office and bring the kids, unbelievable Christmas parties. And so I'd ridden a horse for one afternoon at Belmont, and he was very good friends with Whitey Ford. So Whitey Ford was at the races. I believe the horse won. And Caesar said, "Hey, you know, Whitey and I are going to go get some dinner. Why don't you come have dinner with us?" And so I go out to dinner with Caesar Kimmel and Whitey Ford. And, you know, it's like, you know, pretty cool, you know. And so we're at dinner and having a really nice time and laughing and telling stories. And Whitey Ford tells a story that, to me, one of the greatest ever. He, Mickey Mantle, and Billy Martin, our buddies, drinking buddies, do everything together. They used to go hunting up in Columbia County, upstate New York, about an hour from where I live. And they had a farmer that used to allow them to hunt the property, go deer hunting. And the guy sold the property. So they're driving up there, and they're like, "You think this guy who bought the property is going to allow us to?" And Mickey Mantle says, "Let me handle it." He goes, "I'll knock on the door. What's the guy going to say? I'm Mickey Mantle, right?" So Billy Martin and Whitey Ford hang back by the car. He goes, knocks on the farmer's door. The guy's like, "Oh, my God, Mickey Mantle." He goes, "Yes, you know, the farmer, the previous owner, let us hunt this property. Do you mind if we continue?" "No, not at all. This is amazing. You know, go ahead." He goes, "But listen, I have an old mare in the back over there. I know I should put her down. I just don't have the heart to do it. Would you mind taking care of it? Put her down for me, shoot her, basically." And Mickey Mantle says, "Sure, fine, but do you mind if I have a little bit of fun with my friends?" And he goes, "Yeah, no, go ahead." So he goes out there, and he goes to Whitey Ford and Billy Martin. "You believe this SOB won't let us hunt the property? God damn it." And he shoots the mare, like he's mad.
Ah,
right behind him, blam, blam, Billy Martin shot two cows. "Yeah, to hell with that SOB." "Oh, my God." They had to pay the guy for the cows. Yeah, and he was dead serious. He goes, "That happened. That's how Billy Martin was. He was like, yeah, to heck with this guy. We'll get him, you know."
Oh, my God. That's hysterical. Yeah. Oh, my God. Is that written? Is that story written anywhere, or is it apocryphal, you know, kind of a story?
I don't know. I just know he told us that, and me and Caesar were on the floor. And the way he told it much better than me, and you know, really painted the picture where they would go hunting, and you know, but you know, like, and on a little bit more of a serious note, because these are all great stories, but you know, like, it's never lost on me how incredibly blessed, you know, I've been in the adventures that I've been able to have, and why? Because I could ride a horse. I've, you know, literally got to see the world from the back of a horse and meet people that, you know, how would I ever met, you know, 90% of these people, you know, Whitey Ford and people like this throughout my life. I really, it's never lost on me. I'm always somewhat amazed by it that, like, wow, you know, I'm a kid from Brooklyn still in my heart, you know.
No doubt. And it's, you know, it's one of the, and you've written that, you've made that point before where you've said, you know, when you think about it, you know, with those drives from Belmont or Aqueduct, you know, back to the farm, or from Saratoga to the farm, because until they actually build a racetrack right by you, you're going to have to make those drives.
Yeah.
but you obviously, you know, you appreciate that, and you know, the opportunity, you know, that it's afforded you. I mean, you've said this many times that you recognize how fortunate and what this career, you know, has done for you. And then also, you know, the meeting Mel, and then having, you know, the wonderful family you've got, and you know, all the things that are going to come with that long term with, you know, a passel of grandchildren.
Well, please, that I can't wait for you. You know, I think I'm going to be like the cool grandpa, because the kid's going to have a pony the day they're born. It's going to be right here. They're going to want to go see Grandpa Meg, go see their pony, and be off in the woods and teaching them stuff. But, you know, I'm 16 years old, Steve. I had flown on a plane exactly once in my life, and it was to go ride a steak in Chicago. That was the first time I ever flew. The second time I ever flew on a plane was to go to ride the very first Japan Cup. And we had to fly, and I'm by myself, and I had to fly from, you know, JFK, and we land in Alaska and, like, refuel or change planes in Alaska. That's what it was, because we had to get out and be in the terminal. And then the rest of the way to Alaska, and I was with Cassius Musen, and his mom came along, and looking back on it, she was so sweet, because I was a little bit nervous and overwhelmed. Like, you know, I'm not that far removed from Brooklyn, and second time flying, going to Tokyo, like, you know, I don't belong here. And she kind of ponied me through the whole thing. Like, she saw that, and she couldn't have been sweeter or kinder about it. And but when we landed in Alaska, I remember being in such wonderment, because, you know, you're a kid reading about Alaska in school, Seward's Folly, all this stuff, right? And now you land in Alaska, and the one thing I wanted to know was, like, does this mean now I can say, like, I've been in Alaska, even though I never got to leave the airport? Like, is another state I could check off that I've actually made it to, and going to Alaska, and, you know, wandering around Tokyo, seeing Mount Fuji, and going, like, how did I get here? It's just, like, crazy.
Tina's got me watching some crazy thing in Alaska. It's like a, you know, it's like whatever, one of those survival shows, but it's a lot rougher. They're 10 people in Alaska for, you know, as long as they have to be, and they got to bring 10 things each or something. I think it's called Alone. I believe it's not Home Alone.
But that's real Survivor. Those people,
yeah,
are survivors.
It's like crazy.
They're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't worry about anybody voting them out. They worry about the elements in Mother Nature voting them out.
Well, you got one guy's worried about wolverines eating him, which I think is a, you know, feels like a legitimate concern.
Or a polar bear, you know.
Exactly. It's like, wait a minute, what this is so she's captivated by it. I'd look up every so often. They have to catch their own food and stuff, and it the whole thing seems, I don't know, I came in midpoint. She's been binge watched the thing. It's very strange. Let's get obviously we've got any Monday to go over the racing. Next Monday, you know, we'll be in the shadow of Cigar Mile Day. But Rich, a couple of quick thoughts from the weekend. Christophe Clément couldn't join us today. A huge weekend for Clément, and a couple of stars, it seems, were established, I thought, over the weekend in New York. That Muta Makina and Dylan Davis's terrific ride, you know, zipping up the rail. Bill Mott has got a horse that is obviously, you know, going to be going places. That Forza de Oro to win the Discovery. A couple of thoughts about what you saw over the weekend.
Yeah, well, we'll start with Forza de Oro. There's so much upside with that horse. He has so much ability, and he did a lot of things right in the Discovery, but he still hasn't even put it all together, and he's, you know, that good. Like, to me, he's a horse when the light bulb goes completely on, we're going to see something really serious. I mean, he's very good now, but wait until his mentality catches up with his physicality. You know, he broke better from the gate in the Discovery, which has been, you know, a bit of a bugaboo for him. Still very late changing leads, but when you saw him, you know, in the pocket, you know, cruising up behind Monday Morning QB, who I think is a very good horse, coming off a big win against older horses in Maryland, He's special, and there's a lot of room for more improvement and development. Very impressed with him. And Muta Mokhina, listen, Kristoff is such a horseman, a horseman's horseman, somebody that I admire so much. And, my son Joseph has grown up with Miguel, his son, and watch Miguel become such a key component in his father's barn and work for it. You know, he wasn't handed to him. He was sent to Europe and did the Dolly Flying Start and worked in other yards over in Europe and you know, got a full overview of the game and has put the time in. I'm so proud of him and watching his development and, again, him becoming a key component in the barn and in this barn's success. And to think about, you know, Kristoff, and to be consistently this good all year, not have a big meet and then a lull, and which is going to happen when you're not a huge stable. I mean, he's got a lot of horses, but not compared to some of the other, you know, big barns that have more bench strength, if you will. But Muta Mokhina was very good. She should have won the Zagora, very unlucky. Dylan contributed a terrific ride. And, you know, Dylan and I have a lot of conversations, my brother Michael being his agent, me knowing him since he's an infant, basically, you know, and riding against his dad, Robbie, and Robbie and I are friends now, not so much when we were riding. You know, talking to him about certain basics that I believe in about riding, certain, you know, foundational things, you know, get your position going forward, never take anything away that comes easy, saving ground, particularly on the turf, and don't be looking, always thinking about an escape route. Think about going forward and clocking the horses in front of you, studying the horse in front of you, who you can follow, who's going to be live cover, who's going to take you through the gaps or carry you if they're in front. You know, you watch horses and how they're carrying their tail, how their hind end is underneath them, if they're leaning left, if they're leaning right. These are all little things when you're in behind horses in the midst of a race. You've got to be studying and know instinctually what their moves are, if they're, you know, getting ready to come back to you, because you can see they're weakening from the way they're carrying their hind end. And that comes with experience, but it also comes with discipline. And I talked to Dylan a great deal about discipline. When you're disciplined, you hang in there. You don't bail out of the spot. Because how many times do you see a guy bail out of a spot and someone else takes the same spot and gets through? I mean, we see it time and time again. You got to be the guy with the nerves of steel to stay in there. And in the Long Island, to me, that was the most that Dylan has ever done that. Like, he made a decision, and I'm going to stay in here and stay disciplined, and I've got horse, and I'm going to get through. And it was an absolutely tremendous ride from him, and the kind of ride that makes him believe in the things I'm saying, that he'll start doing that with more consistency. And, you know, you think about jockeys are the only athletes, and you know, I know people have a hard time relating to jockeys as athletes because they're smaller than average people. But you know what? They are, to me, the purest form of athlete. They don't make money. It's a performance-based endeavor. If you don't win, you don't make money. You don't win, you don't get opportunities. You've got to produce every day. If you get injured, you're not getting paid. It's not like you have a contract. You have to get up and do it every day with a consistency and steel your mind and body up. So to me, they're the purest form of athletes in a lot of ways. And then throw into the fact that, you know, besides the danger and an ambulance following you around, you've got to make a specific weight every day. Not like a boxer who, you know, and I have the utmost respect for boxers. Everybody knows what a big boxing fan I am. But, you know, you don't have a fight 6 months from now and, all right, I got to get down to this weight and do it and weigh out and then I can rehydrate. You've got to do it every day, pretty much 365. And, you know, so to you know, have an athlete that basically doesn't have a coach. Jockeys do not have a coach. Every other athlete, a golfer has a coach. He has a swing coach. He's a baseball player. A jockey has no one to point these things out to them. So it's so important, I think, that when you have you know, somebody who wants to learn and they're interested and they can take criticism, because I've been hard on him at times. He knows I wasn't crazy about his ride in the Cumley, and he heard about it. And it's going to help them. It's going to make them see things that maybe they're unaware of, or habits to develop and they're unaware of. You know, being the guy that wants to get out to the clear, you know, especially on the turf. It's a little different dirt racing. You got to build into your stride more. Horses don't quicken through kickback as much. But in the turf, there's no excuse. Hang in there. So, you know, I think him having, and listen, he's got his dad, but, you know, I tried to teach some of my kids how to drive. You know, they had to go to driver's ed. I can't teach them. You're kids. It's different, you know. So to have, you know, that relationship with him and see his development is particularly satisfying for me. And, you know, when I taught the apprentice jockey program in New York, I really loved that. That was like my favorite thing to do because I like to educate. I like to, you know, and part of that's what we do on TV, trying to open up people's minds and look at it a little different than maybe they've ever had before, because it's never been explained in a different way. You know, I enjoy that, and I enjoy seeing that progression, and I've seen it so much with Dylan. I think he rides so much more aggressively, so much more forward. And again, showing that discipline in the Long Island to me really spoke to, like, man, he's really getting it, and he's a seriously talented young kid.
Well, and since we went in this direction, we could talk about a couple of other rides and riders, multiple, because I made the point after Shug wins the Comley with Mrs. Danvers. That was his third win in the Comley. But I made the point that Jose Lascano, and since we're also talking, you know, guys that aren't necessarily included readily in the, you know, in the pantheon with the, you know, the Ortizes and you know, the and the Rosarios, Jose Lascano and Junior Alvarado both deserve some real attention and appreciation. Lascano sensed immediately that nobody was going to be aggressive in that Comley, and Mrs. Danvers wins. I mean, not only was she ready, obviously, to run a big race, but he took control of that race and just throttled everybody. And Lascano has been riding at a elite level. And Junior Alvarado, you know, very quietly, who, you know, has been recognized for particularly for his ability in route going. Doug Salvatore came up a couple of years ago with the amazing stat that Alvarado has a rare number, a positive ROI in route races. I mean, it's like a crazy thing. And both he and Lascano, I thought, you know, really distinguished themselves over the weekend.
I agree, but they've been doing it consistently for a while, as you pointed out. They, you know, they may get more attention because of rides like you know, on Mrs. Danvers, on Forza de Oro, but they're doing it on a consistent basis. And let's talk about Jose Lascano first. He's a guy that his business is more spread out. He doesn't have a main outfit, but it's a credit to him and his agent, Jason Bides, that they're alive in pretty much every outfit. You know, he's not, let's say, Chad Brown's go-to guy, but he gets good opportunities, you know, when it presents itself for Chad, and he makes the most of them. For Shug, again, not maybe his number one go-to guy, but then gets a shot on Mrs. Danvers, and in that particular ride, this is why I always say, you come out running, you don't come out looking, because to me, that encourages someone else to take the initiative. If you come out running, maybe you close the door on that guy's idea. You know, and that was my thing. I thought maybe Dylan should have come out much more aggressive on Miss Marissa. And then maybe he looks over and goes, oh, he's going to go, I take back. Now you've staked claim to controlling the race. When I was riding, particularly on the inner track and speed was so good, I would, you know, do my handicapping off the form, and then I would go look at race replays, because a horse that has speed maybe doesn't have what I consider gate speed. Their first two or three steps are not their best. But my horse, who has maybe similar amount of speed, has better gate speed. His first few steps are better than that horse. So I would come out with the idea that I am going to claim it before that horse really reaches his full stride. I'm not going to give him an opportunity to, you know, then get emboldened to go forward, and now we're either in a speed duel or he's in front, I've got to chase him. So if I could get the drop, if you will, you know, beat them out of the gate. If they're inside of me, get in front of them, throw dirt at them. We'll put them in so close that the other guy goes, okay, I'll follow, and basically make up their mind for them. And I think that's exactly what you saw with Jose. They broke. He, in an instant, and we're talking split seconds here, but this is what a jockey has to be able to do, process that quickly. Hey, I am going to control this and make everybody else adjust around me. Now, Mrs. Danvers was very, very good, and maybe it doesn't matter under any, you know, circumstance, but I also feel like she's a filly that hasn't shown a great desire to pass horses. You know, when she gets next to one, she kind of almost a little cultish in some ways, kind of run with them, hang on them a little bit. But once she's broken through that plane, like I used to love to put a horse that would hang on the lead. They've already broken through that plane. I don't have to worry about them getting to somebody and hanging on them. Now they got to catch me. And that was a prime example, but this is something Jose Lascano has done consistently all year. Getting forward position, being aggressive, making decisions, and not having decisions made for him. And that's what a jockey's supposed to do. I can always forgive a rider's mistakes if they're an aggressive mistake and their own mistake. Thought out, didn't work, but you had an intention. I can't stand when I see a rider be passive and he's forced into a mistake by somebody else's thought process. That good riders do not get put in that position. And then you get, you know, I mean, Junior, he's tremendous. And you see him on the turf. He will save ground. He's a strong finisher. He's the package. But it also speaks to the depth of the colony here that guys like this, who potentially could dominate almost any place else, are one of 8 or 10 guys that are just that good. And it depends on, you know, what outfits they have locked up. You know, I mean, Irad and Jose have some of the bigger outfits locked up. Joel Rosario, I mean, this guy, I think watching them, like Joel Rosario, when he's on and he's in his zone, which he is right now, who's better? It's fun to watch. I mean, a lot of prime talent. And Steve, I talk about this because, you know, my experience was there's a window for a rider where that perfect balance of youth, your body's not that beat up, you know, you haven't had that many bad injuries, you know, your physicality is at its peak, and your experience level where your mentality is at its peak. They both have reached that same place at the same time. As you ride and get older, your physicality is going to wane. It's going to break down. You just can't continue your body at that level. Now, your experience level is always going to continue to gain and improve, but there's a certain period of time, and that's when the riders in their prime, where their physicality and their mentality match. They're on the same plane. And right now, you have probably a dozen, you know, maybe 18, 20 riders in the country, go Tyler Gaffleone and different areas, Flavor Pratt, where they're at that zenith. They're at that place. You know, and to me, like Jerry Bailey, one of the greatest riders of all time, his zenith, his balance of that was the longest I've ever seen it last. I think, you know, honestly, there was about 15 years where Jerry's physicality and mentality were on the same plane. And one of the best riders ever, with maybe, you know, I would put him in the top five, but the thing that made him stand out was how long, and that's what I call a rider's prime. His prime was the longest I've ever seen any rider, and he was very fortunate. He didn't get injured, you know, for a while. I honestly, and people say this and they might scratch their head, I honestly think my prime was about 3 years because I just got beat up. I got beat to hell. I mean, I broke my neck the first time I was 22 years old. And I was so well schooled when I started that I think my prime was like from 19 to 22. And yeah, I was a good rider after, but I never was quite the same physically. I could see a race. I saw the things I wanted to do. I couldn't always make my body do what I wanted it to do. But, you know, I had rode a long time. I rode 29 full years. If you take away the 37 months I missed from injury, I rode about 26 years. But that being said, you know, I see right now a lot of riders that are in that place. They're at the pinnacle. They're in their prime.
And gotta wrap up, but one thing that comes to mind when you discuss this is the fascinating dynamic when, and I'm thinking over the 15 years and just in the time I've been involved doing the show, where there's been a spate of retirements and riders that, you know, that left, and there would be a, you know, this cacophony of, well, oh, the era of great riders is over. There'll never be a group like this again. And then, you know, about 10 minutes later, you realize there's seven or eight guys here that are, you know, that were 22. Now they're 26, 28 and 30 and they're in their prime and they're, you know, elite riders. I mean, there's always going to be a group of elite riders, and that, you know, the cream's going to rise to the top because there's always going to be a talent, you know, that comes along. And, you know, whether it's a talent that was taught at a riding academy or whether it's, you know, somebody that's just like a natural, that's got natural ability, you know, they're going to come along. And then as they get more and more experienced, they're only going to enhance their natural gifts or the education they received.
Oh, absolutely, and you know, listen. I think that's just human nature. You know, when you fall in love with something, any sport, you're going to kind of adore or elevate that era. You know, whether it be boxing or hockey, you're like, wow, that was like the good old days kind of syndrome. Right now, I'm seeing a lot of young talent, and they're always going to be coming down the pike, and when you have kids that are willing to work hard, the one thing that I hope people understand, like, of course, riders are open to criticism. They're an athlete. They're in a public forum that people are wagering on them. But sometimes I feel like there's a little bit of lack of respect for what they do, and maybe it's because people have a hard time relating to riders because they really haven't had the opportunity to ride horses, you know, let alone at a competitive level. But they're just tough. And they're really strong, and they're very brave, you know, braver than people realize. You know, an athlete in most other sports make a mistake. What's the worst that's going to happen? A jockey makes a mistake, it could cost them their life, you know, or they could be paralyzed or permanently impaired in some way. So I just wish people would take a second and respect that aspect of it just a little bit more. And then throw in the fact that most of the time, you know, I lived on 700 calories a day for the majority of my career. You know, to think about that when people mindlessly eat and drink and, you know, whatever they want, it's a whole different level. It's a whole different level of commitment. It's not an endeavor. It's not a job. It's not a career. It's a way of life.
Exactly. And, you know, you and Tony, you know, we've fleshed this out and discussed it, you know, many times. Well, let's pull up and Rich, absolutely fabulous, and jump in on the Twitter conversation where we've already got half a dozen people talking about sporting events that they left. I imagine a couple of people may have turned away from the racetrack thinking that the race was over, but it's not really the same. You may look away for a second, but you always look back, and it's great to look back at whether we're looking back at the weekend or the week, or we're looking back at decades. Rich Migliori, everybody. And Richie, next week, of course, Cigar Mile Day. And there is one more broadcast, but we'll do some recapping next week.
Well, I'll be watching from home, so I'll be on top of it, and I look forward to talking to you next week, Steve.
Richard Migliori on Twitter, folks. If you're not following Richie, you should be. And we're going to take a break here, our last of the morning. And when we come back, an hour, a little less than an hour of action, including Jerry McLennan, Cousin Jerry, as he's known around the Pompa family. And the whole family was on hand Saturday. Two wins, including the stake win by Turned Aside in the Turf Sprint Championship. And there was also a nice first out maiden winner called Spirit Maker. Jerry's going to join us and pay tribute to Paul Pompa and talk about what it felt like on Saturday and how special it was for the family. Mike Welch to follow as well. And because tomorrow, Giving Tuesday, going to have Kim Weir visit from TRF before we wrap up today. Back after this, Hour 3.
The latest racing news. It's At The Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed.